All right, well, today is part six of our series on unnatural relations, that is homosexuality. And the material today will rely quite heavily on what has been covered in the previous 2 weeks. And so if you are a visitor, hopefully you'll be able to kind of follow along okay this morning. There are several reasons why we're working through this subject. I won't take time now to go over all of them again, but one that I do want to keep pressing is that we need to be equipped to help those who struggle in this area. We need to understand the causes that contribute to same-sex attraction itself and what leads people to eventually embrace that as a lifestyle, and what sorts of change can be expected for those who want to change and so on. And we also need to be well-grounded in what the Bible says and doesn't say about homosexuality. And so this is, of course, a very relevant subject and one that I want us to work through very carefully, and this is why we're taking a number of weeks for this subject. Today, I want to move from the question of causes to change. Can homosexuality be cured, if I could use that word? Every one of us really needs to be prepared for this sort of question, because a day may well come when a friend or a family member or a coworker or someone else may come up to you and, knowing that you are a Christian, may confide with you about their struggles with this and will ask for your help and advice. And obviously, you would want at some point to direct them to a professional Christian counselor who has some training and experience in this area. But as a friend, as a support person, what sorts of initial advice would you offer in an occasion like that? Is change possible? If so, what kind of change would it be? And so what I want to do this morning is simply highlight a few essential points that every believer should understand and draw upon when offering such help or advice. And this, again, is going to be on a pretty basic level, but it should provide some helpful direction, clarifying the priorities and expectations that we should have on this question. It basically is, you know, this is what needs to be pressed, but this thing over here isn't really that much of an issue. Just try to sort through some of that stuff. That's part one for the morning. Part two of this morning will be led by Tom Detmer, or in this setting we'll refer to him as Dr. Tom Detmer, who is a licensed clinical psychologist, and he's going to offer his input on the material that we have covered so far, especially on the subjects of causes and cures. And then Tom will open it up for questions on those particular subjects. So you might be thinking along those lines. If there's something you'd like to ask, this would be a good opportunity for that. Again, pertaining specifically to the question of causes and cures. All right, the whole question of change is an extremely controversial one, often polarized by two opposite responses. On the one side are those who believe any attempts at change are not only futile, but even immoral. In fact, you may remember that efforts are underway in California that would make it illegal for counselors to offer treatment to minors that would attempt to diminish or eliminate homosexual desires. And adults would have to sign a consent form acknowledging that such therapy would be both ineffective and dangerous. And this is more or less the prevailing thought today, that if your orientation is homosexual, then you need to be true to yourself and not try to fix it. On the other side are those who believe that with determination and the right kind of counseling, one can change his or her sexual desires from homosexual to heterosexual. It simply comes down to a matter of the will, that those desires themselves could actually change. Between those two opposite positions lies everything else. And so what I want to do this morning is I'm going to lay out one area where change is unlikely and unreasonable to expect. And then I'll present two areas where change is not only possible and reasonable, but for the believer, it's expected and required. And then two areas where change is possible, can and should be pursued, but progress will vary from person to person. Some will see progress, others the progress will be quite slow and minimal, and for others, yet perhaps no real change to speak of at all. Of these five areas that we're going to look at today, change is only required in the eyes of God in the two that are actually the easiest to change. And for our purposes this morning, I'm approaching the question of change as it pertains to a convert, to someone who has embraced the gospel and is striving to live under the lordship of Christ. This has to be the starting point. It is foundational to everything else. As you can see, unless a person submits to Jesus, I'm just going to wait. Who is it? All right, thanks. Gary. Where's Gary? Gary left. The whole place is falling apart. Who wants to be the bouncer? I need to get a bouncer. Jeff, you're a cop. You want to be the bouncer? Why don't you come in early every Sunday morning and just kind of like collect cell phones and weapons and all that other stuff that people, all the contraband that comes in here? That'd be a big basket. All right. Didn't mean to embarrass you, Tim. Did I embarrass you? Oh, it was John. Oh, I'm sorry. A visitor. I'm really sorry now. It's okay. You can let it ring as much as you want. We just want you to feel good while you're with us. So. It is falling apart. I think new leadership is in the horizon somewhere in all of this. All right, let me go back. I don't know how we're going to edit the MP3 file in this one, but all right, for our purposes this morning, I am approaching the question of change as it pertains to a convert, to someone who has embraced the gospel and is striving to live a life under the lordship of Christ. And that, as you see, has to be the starting point. And it really is foundational to everything else. Unless a person submits to Jesus and the authority of his word, then I'm really not sure what hope could be offered. Perhaps there could be some hope, but the whole process would be quite difficult without the objective moral foundation that God provides and the help that can be found in his word and by his spirit. And also, what I will be sharing will be more applicable to males than to females. Some things may pertain to women, but when it comes to the issue of change, men have a much harder time and face a different kind of struggle. And so this is where most of my attention will be directed today. And so here we go, starting with the first one. When it comes to same-sex attraction itself, it is unlikely that it will ever go away, at least completely. If a man has been primarily attracted to men, he will most likely continue to experience some degree of those desires and probably for the rest of his life. This is especially true if he had ever acted on those desires, and even more so if he had given himself over to a homosexual lifestyle for any period of time. And so if approached for advice or help or support, it is reckless for any of us to claim that such desires can be replaced or transformed or eliminated, even if he were to abstain from homosexual activity and even if he were to experience a dramatic conversion to the Christian faith. Now, you may be surprised to hear me say this sort of thing, but it actually comes from those who know best, men who were once practicing homosexuals themselves, who now live heterosexual lives and are involved in full-time ministry of helping others out of homosexuality. And I believe Tom will probably speak to this when he comes up later. Even after conversion to Christ, and even after forsaking homosexual activity for 20 or more years, experiencing an occasional desire or temptation is not uncommon. Now, this is not so much the case for women. Many women involved in lesbian relationships will often pursue heterosexual relationships later on with little or no lingering homosexual desires. And there are probably a number of reasons for this difference, but one would be the nature of the sex drive itself. Generally speaking, men who pursue homosexual relationships are seeking sexual satisfaction more than companionship. Companionship is certainly a need, but more times than not, it is the fulfillment of the strong biological drive that is the main force. And if their craving is homosexual, well, how does one change what one craves? And generally speaking, women who pursue homosexual relationships are seeking companionship more than sexual satisfaction. In relationships, they tend to crave emotional intimacy, which they often don't find in men. If they were to experience this with a man, they would be more inclined to pursue a heterosexual lifestyle. Now, there are, of course, exceptions to this, so I don't want you to think of this as some sort of universal or absolute principle here, but more times than not, we find these differences in what men crave and what women crave, and they help explain why it is harder for most men to change than for most women. Even if a man were to marry and find fulfillment in both a heterosexual lifestyle and in heterosexual sex itself, it is still likely that he will continue to experience some level of temptation with same-sex attraction. Now, certainly, it is possible that this could eventually fade away, or for that matter, be something God could instantly deliver him from. But any kind of complete release would be the exception, not the norm. And this is the point, a responsible Christian seeking to help a man struggling in this area will be careful to not give him false hopes or unreasonable expectations about this, because doing so will only set him up for frustration and disappointment, which could, of course, lead him to just give up and then return to homosexuality. All right, now for the two areas where change is not only possible and reasonable, but for the Christian, change is expected. The first one is a change in perspective, and this is where it all starts. A practicing homosexual who then embraces the gospel, for instance, can begin to see things from a completely different light. This includes accepting the fact that God has specific intentions for his sexuality, and that these intentions are made known in his word, and that God expects him to conform to them, and so on. He would now, for instance, embrace one of two options for his life, as we talked about before: fidelity in heterosexual monogamy or celibacy in singleness. Embracing the truth of Scripture in all areas, not just in sexuality, is, of course, foundational to this path of deliverance from homosexuality, or for that matter, any sin. The major themes of the fall and the judgment of God and the love of God and the salvation in Christ and the power of the Holy Spirit and the promises of a future eternal kingdom for those who endure to the end and so on, are all essential to shaping the value and belief system of the one who seeks deliverance. And most likely, this perspective, seeing things as God sees them, is going to be radically different than what he had previously embraced or been accustomed to. And along this line, getting a sound perspective on some of the factors that have contributed to his homosexual desires, understanding the root causes of this in his life, can also help him deal correctly with those issues. Forgiving his father, for instance, for the rejection he felt from him as a kid could go a long way in healing the unmet emotional needs that have contributed to his homosexual struggles. And likewise, a woman forgiving the one who molested her would also be a significant step in resolving some of the lingering hurt of the childhood drama. And on we could go with many examples, you know, seeing things from God's perspective and then acting on it. Not only must there be change in perspective, but there must be a change in behavior, number two under this heading. And that really is the goal here. And when it comes down to it, this isn't any different than how we resist sin to any temptation. And so if you are being called upon to come along and offer support, then you would want to point out the numerous verses that offer help in this, passages that talk about the nature of temptation and the importance of relying on God's grace and help. The place of prayer, and how no temptation is beyond what we can bear, and that God always provides an escape from it, and so on, including how we should, the best we can, avoid situations that would expose us unnecessarily to temptation. Again, this is no different than going to battle with any other sin. A man who struggles with homosexual temptation is not that much different than a man who struggles with heterosexual temptation. And the remedy in both situations is the same, to exercise self-restraint and refuse to yield to the sin. And that sin, of course, would involve everything from having an actual sexual encounter with another person to viewing pornography to even entertaining lustful fantasies, which Jesus, of course, condemned. There is a point at which an actual decision is made to either yield to the temptation or to resist it. There is a choice involved. The person is in control. We should never think otherwise about that. And God has promised that no temptation comes our way that is impossible to resist. And so again, a change in behavior is not only possible and reasonable, but for the believer, this change is expected. And he is the one who's ultimately in charge of that. All right, and now for two areas where change is possible, but will vary from person to person. Some will see much progress, others not so much, and for some, perhaps none at all. But nonetheless, efforts can and should be pursued. The first one is a change in frequency of homosexual attractions. While living in the lifestyle, temptations, of course, come up all the time. Removing one's self from those opportunities will certainly help with that, along with, very important, developing habits of resisting temptations when they do occur. And we can all relate to this. So there were no doubt sins that you once struggled with many, many years ago that are not that much of a problem for you today because you have made progress in resisting them. And as a result, the frequency of those temptations have diminished over time, though they probably still come up now and then. Again, the key here is concentrating on obeying God in one's behavior. That really needs to be the emphasis. If, however, we get distracted, preoccupied with the temptations and the desires and the attractions, trying to eradicate all that from one's life, it will be an all-consuming, frustrating, futile task. But focusing on behavior is something where the progress is not only measurable, but also achievable. And, more importantly, it is where God places the emphasis as well. And a change in behavior over time will most likely produce a change in the frequency of those temptations. Very similar to this is the next one, a change in the intensity of homosexual attractions. The same principles apply. Again, this comes primarily from one's growth and maturity in the Christian faith. But much of this, of course, depends upon factors that had contributed to these desires in the first place and how extensive one was caught up in the behavior itself and the depth of depravity that he or she sunk into and, of course, the amount of time that they were involved. And so for some, they will see much progress in this area. Others, for instance, might not see that much. All right, so to sum it up, it is unlikely that sexual attraction toward members of the same sex would ever be completely eliminated. It would therefore be irresponsible to lead someone to expect that. For in so doing, we would be setting them up for frustration and disappointment, which could cause them to abandon any hope for pressing on. It is possible that the frequency and intensity of sexual attraction could diminish if there is a change in perspective and a change in behavior, which is where the attention needs to be focused on. What counts as we stand before God are not changes in desires, because those are pretty much outside one's control anyway, but what can be controlled, how one thinks and how one behaves. One must believe what God says about homosexuality and act accordingly. To what extent each type of change is experienced would obviously vary from person to person. Counseling, then, will help the homosexual manage existing attractions and temptations and explore his or her potential for heterosexual ones as well. However, the outcome isn't likely to be a conversion of one into the other, but rather a decrease of the one and hopefully an increase of the other. And even then, we'd want to be careful about making overly optimistic expectations about all of that. All right, at this time, I'm going to have our brother Tom come up. I heard some giggling when I called him Dr. Tom, but he is a doctor, and but here in the assembly, we refer to him as Tom. So come on up, and why don't you share with us some thoughts over the material that we've covered here, some things that you'd like to add to it, and then we'll open it up for questions, and then we'll take those as they come. Great. Thanks, Tom.
A little bit, but I think we're both, I think, very much on the same page that what Wendell has, what he's covered and how he's done it has been very comprehensive and very responsible. It's well researched and well thought out, and there's nothing that really jumps out to, I think, Drew or I, either one, that we would say we really need to amend this or think differently about that. I mean, Wendell's done a very nice job kind of from start to finish with the entire process. So having said that, there's two things I would like to do this morning. One is that Wendell referenced that sometimes with molestation, that can be in some ways enjoyable, and that causes problems. So I want to explain that a little bit. And along with that, explain a little bit why complete cessation of desires, especially for men, is difficult. And those are the same processes at work. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And then I have, kind of depending on how long that takes, I just have a few examples of people I've either known well or seen in practice, and their experience, who are homosexual, and their experience with the lifestyle is worth kind of mentioning with you, because it's what Wendell described. In any of the different kind of combinations of reasons that Wendell described, are things that this is what people report as to how things get going. And so I think that would be useful as a way to make what Wendell has talked about more real. And then we're going to do questions, depending on time. Okay. And again, I think to say that our goals would be that that we understand the issue, and also to have increased empathy for those who have the struggle. Because I certainly know people who are in the gay lifestyle who I find in many ways kind of difficult to tolerate, because they're so steeped in it and they seem angry, etc. However, as I understand the path that got them there, I do have a greater level of empathy for them, even though I don't like kind of what they stand for necessarily now. But to do the first part, which is this whole idea of how could something that would be unpleasant like molestation be enjoyable, and the whole idea of why it's difficult for certain desires to go away. That is, in psychology, there's several different ways that human beings learn. One of those is the reward punishment, that those behaviors that are rewarded or reinforced, we want to do again. Those that are punished, we don't want to do again. And that's operant conditioning in psychology, that as you operate on the environment, those things that reinforce you, you do again. Those that are punishing, you don't. But the other form that really explains what Wendell's talking about is what we call classical conditioning. And a lot of you have probably read about Pavlov's dogs or have studied him. And this exact principle is what's going on in what Wendell is describing. Ivan Pavlov, he was a Russian physiologist in about 1900. And the study that this all came from is he was interested in the digestive processes of dogs. And that's what he was studying. So he had, if you could imagine, he has a number of dogs that are kind of lined up. And what he's doing is he's giving them meat powder, and he is measuring then how much they salivate. That's the whole goal of his research. And so as he designed it, he had the dogs. He would have his participants, or he would ring a bell, and his participants would give the dogs meat powder, and then he would measure how much did they salivate. And so this is going on and on. And the very interesting thing happened that over time, as the bell was rung and meat was given, what he found is that those two things were put together. Basically what happened is dogs began to salivate to the bell with no food. And this was kind of a revolutionary study in psychology. It's this thing we call classical conditioning. And what happens is physiologically, when two things are paired together over time, the one that would otherwise not elicit any kind of response now elicits a response. And it's a very powerful kind of learning. It can happen either over time when two things are put together, or it can happen with one kind of big thing that's very intense that otherwise wouldn't elicit a response. It's exactly how phobias begin. This is exactly how PTSD happens. I mean, for me, you guys know, maybe some of you know, that I have a kind of a thing with flying. And I flew my whole life, and we loved it. It was great. And I had one incident in 1996 when we came back from Nashville, when we were in a little six-seater airplane, and we were in pretty severe turbulence. And I thought we were dying. And it was a very intense fear for me. And then I didn't fly for 6 years because the very idea of flying elicited great fear, because it had been associated in one experience with this experience where I thought I was going to die. And so that's classical conditioning kind of in a one event kind of nutshell. It also happens in events over time. But what I want to say, getting back to the whole issue then of molestation, the thing that's really difficult for especially boys when that happens is that there is something very pleasurable about sexual activity. That's how God created us. And if you pair an unpleasant experience, molestation at the hands of somebody it shouldn't be happening with, and it happens to be a man, but you put that together with a sexual experience, something gets conditioned at an emotional and physiological level that's very difficult to get rid of. And it's very very confusing for boys. And a lot of this, it gets back to Wendell talk about there are a lot of different, I don't know how you termed it, but there's kind of an interactive approach. A lot of things are at play, whether it's temperament or learning or genetics. But depending on, you know, the kind of the temperament of the person, if you have this experience that was awful yet kind of, on the other hand, exciting and pleasurable, it's very confusing. And it's very hard to completely rid yourself of how it felt, and you know the connection. And again, in a few minutes, I want questions about that, because I don't know exactly how many details to go into that. But again, when two things are paired together, whether they should be paired together or not, and they're powerful enough, the one thing can bring about the same feeling as the other. And so it'd be very easy. And one of my examples is a gentleman who he is in a marriage, but he absolutely has times, and it goes back to when he was 12, of when he very much desires to be with men sexually. And it's this classically conditioned response that is very, very hard for him to get rid of. And he tries very hard, but physiologically something happens that's very difficult to extinguish. So as you think about that thing, and I would want to clarify that with questions, but I don't know how much more to say about that. But that's also, again, that's the piece with why molestation can be so difficult for boys, because it is a little bit different sexually for boys. And the whole reason why it then is so hard to extinguish. So if you could imagine, in terms of if you had someone who came who was homosexual and they wanted to not be that way, and they wanted to get rid of all of the feelings they have, another way to think about it is, for any of you in the room who have any kind of phobia, whether it's heights, whatever it is, math, public speaking, going over bridges, kind of the analogy is then that if you could imagine not only not fearing that thing, but loving that thing, that would be the difficult process that we're really asking somebody who has feelings for someone of the same sex in many cases. It's one thing for us to kind of teach how to lessen those, how to have more control over those, but it's a whole other creature to say, we're going to make you now love something different and feel as if you love it. It's a very, very difficult thing. And again, we could be clear that God could do that. If he wanted to, he doesn't always choose in this life to do that for us. And the natural way that he's made us as human beings in terms of how we learn is that when things get paired together, we have strong, strong emotional and physiological reactions. And that's part of the reason that's so difficult. So I'm going to stop with that. And I hope to have some questions that maybe if that wasn't clear, but I want to give now several examples, if I could, of people that I've either known very well and who were homosexual, who were very open about their pasts, or people that I've seen in private practice, and the same thing would apply, that they've been very open about how they got there. And it's interesting, as I list the men, I have several examples of men and several examples of women. And for the women, it's all about what Wendell just said, that it was all about companionship. And for the men, it is more clearly about sex in terms of what drives that lifestyle. And so the first is a 30-year-old woman that I knew who she would describe herself as bisexual, and she was living that. And what she shared about her history is that it was really one abusive relationship after another, And she was more of the, I think, a sensitive, pleasing temperament who put up with that for a long, long time. And then eventually the conclusion she reached is men, I can't find what I'm looking for emotionally in men. And again, she's living outside of a Christian framework, and that will muddy the waters and really screw things up. But her conclusion after years of experience with men in kind of painful, abusive relationships is they can't meet any of my emotional needs. And then she was just a step away from hanging around the people who might say, hey, this is a whole other option. But she was only a step away from saying women are the answer, and that's the step she took. But again, it was a history of abusive relationships that were just painful and bad for her. Another is a good friend of mine that I've known for years, and she was someone who I would have worshipped with and been in church with on a regular basis. She is now in a openly gay lifestyle for the last probably 10 years. And I remember years ago her making a statement, and the only part I remember is when every man in your family has raped you. And I forget what followed that, but she was making the point of what her life had been like. And that was her history with men. And again, kind of the social consequence of that is it's many things. One, she doesn't know what good relationships look like. She doesn't know how to choose men, and she would repeatedly choose awful men. But there's good reasons for that. Again, she's not off the hook for that, but we can look at that and understand that she has no models for how to do relationships. And then she made a number of choices where she took a third shift job, couldn't go to church anymore. She began hanging out with an alternative crowd. And next thing I know, after, I saw her a year later, is that she was in a relationship with a woman. And she said to me that it was something along the lines of, when you find something that will make you happy, you take it. And so, again, everything that Wendell has talked about in terms of origins of it really fits nicely, because what I see is a woman who wanted relationships with men, didn't know how to do it, had a fair number of abusive relationships, and what she found in women was what she described as nurturance and that emotional connection. And it became about sex, but it was companionship and the emotional connection that she was looking for. And so those are the women. For the men, I have a couple interesting examples. I have a man who's about 50. He was molested by his brothers when he was 12 or so. And what I see consistently in the men that I work with is there is a kind of a sensitive temperament, because by nature we're genetically given a different temperament. I'm more of the kind of the tend to be shy and anxious temperament. My wife, completely different. And it's a temperament issue, and part of that is the genetic piece. But I see in a lot of the men that I work with who have struggled with this is more of the sensitive temperament, because the risk-taking temperament can take these events and kind of bury them deep inside and then maybe go misuse women or do other things. But this is a guy who... it plagued him. He didn't really know how to deal with it. He always felt shame because of what had happened because of his brothers. And he's married, and he does well in that relationship. He also has a bipolar disorder, and thing I'd say is that that's one of those overdiagnosed ones. But he has a real one where he has manic episodes where he is grandiose and doesn't need sleep and high risk-taking behaviors. And every time he's manic, this is a guy who what he goes for is gay porn or bisexual porn, kind of brief encounters with men, and then he's remorseful afterwards. But there is this physiological thing that got connected for him that he hates and he doesn't know how to get rid of, and in certain times it is stronger than others, and he wants very much for it not to be the case, and he does really well with it, but he really struggles. And again, had he not had certain events happen early on that connected some things that should never be connected, then he doesn't probably struggle in this way. He would have other sin to struggle with. Another gentleman that I know is he's about 50, and it's another variation of what Wendell talked about. He was a kind of a shy, sensitive temperament. He always was interested in sort of the softer things. And he was raised in a family of men who were very manly and very macho. And from as far back as he can remember, he didn't fit. He felt different from the men. And not only that, but he was mocked and he was put down because he was girly. And so he spent all of his time with his mother and all the other women in the family. And this is a guy who is not homosexual, but everything about him, if anybody in this room, 9 out of 10 people in this room would think that he was homosexual because of how he carries himself, how he talks, how he expresses himself. And so he didn't take that step, but he had everything in place that Wendell talked about, that he's a certain temperament, he was not accepted, he spent time with the women, and he is very ladylike in many ways, and he hasn't taken that step. He's a married guy, but again, he very easily could have, and all the pieces are in place that Wendell would have talked about. They get back to, you know, how fathers need to treat their sons, how we need to accept certain differences that aren't moral differences. And he's someone who it pains him very much that he knows that anytime anybody meets him, they think he's gay or homosexual, and that pains him. But again, he's coming out of an environment where, again, it was not at all a Christian framework, and he was a guy who wasn't very manly, and that was not okay. And again, fortunately, he didn't take the next step, but he certainly could have. And then another interesting thing, a couple guys that I work with at Community Corrections, and the one I met with this week who, again, a very sensitive temperament, who has never felt like he fit, has never felt like he kind of added up to how the other guys are. And I say that because I think that that's important in the choice that can eventually be made of where do I fit? Do I fit with men? Do I not fit with men? But what he talked about is all of the very sad, the multiple brief encounters he had with men, I mean, multiple. And it was an interesting choice of words because he said it was always to fill the void. And so, again, there's this interesting thing that happens where sex gets used because it's pleasurable. And many times it's simply because it's pleasurable, but it's also, it was for him, this sense of it makes me feel connected. And he was also molested when he was younger. And so you have this piece of, I have these feelings that I don't exactly know what to do with, but they're there. I don't fit anywhere. I have this whole community who says this is okay, and temporarily it makes me feel better. And so it's kind of one thing after another. For women, it is companionship. For men, it is much more often kind of pleasure, dominance, power. For him, there's also an emotional component. You know, Wendell handled it so well because there are so many variables. It's not any one thing. You could take two people and give them the same awful early experience, but other things like temperament, the kind of the family emotional atmosphere, are you accepted, are you supported, all of that plays together to bring about potentially a certain result. So it's easy to look at it and say, well, this happened to so-and-so and they didn't turn out that way. But there's a million reasons why they didn't. And I think Wendell just did a great job with explaining that there's any number of forces that can come together. But what I wanted to emphasize this morning is that piece of classical conditioning that we see it repeatedly. Anybody here who has a fear in the room, it's been conditioned classically. And if you can, again, imagine just trying to make those feelings go away when the stimulus is there, it doesn't work that way. And the exact same thing happens, especially for a male, when there's been early experiences that were with a man and sexual. It's very confusing, and it leaves you with a lot of ambivalence. So I think I would want to just pause there and just open up to any questions anybody has about any of that or anything we've talked about. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. He has denied that from the very beginning, and we didn't really come back to that. He's been married. He talks now a lot about he's separated, and that maybe they would be divorced, but he talks about women, and so he denies that was ever the case. He's kind of he denies it, is what I would say. And if you met him, you would think, You would think something else was going on, but he would tell you from the earliest ages, women were the safe place. And he has mannerisms like women. He would shake your hand a little bit like a woman would. I mean, all of that is in place, but he would say that he's not, the homosexual behavior does not call him. Say it again. Would that be what? Yeah, that's on you. I don't see that very often. I mean, that's the first I've seen of someone who, I mean, everything looks there, and they would say, I don't wrestle with that at all. But he also had no early sexual experiences with men. I think it's an important difference because, again, Wendell talked about the genetic piece, and the jury is completely out on that. But even if the genetic piece, even if it were proven that there is something that leads to kind of a homosexual tendency, that's really stingless for the Orthodox for the same reasons that you outlined today, because all of us are wrong in one way or another. But having said, I say all that because I don't see lots of evidence in people that I work with that they had perfect lives and then had a homosexual bent. There's almost always something that really explains it. So I don't know if that answers your question. Yeah.
How would you decondition
that? How do you reverse it?
You
can do it. It's kind of, I mean, the first step, I think, is learning to deal with the feelings when they come. So, for example, if I'm on an airplane, the last thing I need to do when it gets turbulent is imagine the wings breaking off, which I can do very easily. Really. And that produces fear. So I have a certain kind of, as it gets more turbulent on an airplane, I am unable to convince myself that I'm safe. That's impossible. But the thing that I can do is I can learn to put some parameters on how I think and what I think about. I can talk to my wife. I can get distracted in a book, but I have a number of things that I do that interrupt the thought process because emotion and feeling comes from thinking. That's how it works. So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to learn how to kind of block the thoughts or recognize the thoughts and put some parameters on them. And that what that will do is decrease kind of the physiological response that you get. And that's kind of step one, which is a huge step. That's what you're going to do with anybody who has any kind of phobia. You're going to do it with PTSD. But then that other step that would eventually would be ideal of how do you make the feared thing pleasant is a very difficult thing, but it's the same kind of process that you would, you know, drive me to the airport and give me $100. And you would drive me to the airport the next time and get me on a plane and give me a box of candy. But you're gonna pair things that are unpleasant with now things that are pleasant over time. And you can recondition, but it's very difficult. And when you step, because there's something so physiological about the conditioning process, whether it's sexual feelings or fear, that makes it so powerful. I mean, heart rate changes, blood pressure changes, sweat production, all of this changes in a very powerful way. Chemicals in your head start to change. And so it can all be reconditioned, but it is very, very, very difficult. So that's the short answer. Right.
And I went in the art wing, and on the first wall were two nudes in a high school.
Two nudes?
Nudes.
Yeah.
And I was talking to the lady whose office door opened up, and there party where two boys kiss and two girls kiss and a boy and a girl kiss. What do we do with this word tolerance? How should we handle a situation like that?
Well, okay, Wendell says he's going to get to that.
Okay, you'll have to be here that day, Gary.
I'll be here.
Okay, one more. I'm glad you said that. Say it. Are they suffering from some kind of...
Well, was there some type of emotional or physical abuse?
Yeah. Yeah. In men, my experience is that... The difference I see in the kind of the small sample I get is women, it has more to do with men have consistently failed me in relationships in very bad ways to the point that I've given up that there's any hope. And for men, it tends to be that there is some kind of sexual experience early on that now they carry with them this, I may not want it, but I'm really attracted to this. And that's the difference I see. And it usually sits with a more sensitive kind of temperament. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess I was looking at maybe a contrasting the aspect of abuse versus maybe just the tendency through, I'm just made that way.
Yeah. Well, I see a little bit of the made that way. But again, almost always, and I would not say without exception, but almost always you can look back at the dynamics in early life and see what would have happened. Because a lot of folks I work with who would say, this is just how I am, would be the ones 10 weeks later to say, well, I was also molested for men. And so that's not uncommon. That's not always the case, but that's 90% of what I see with men. And the other thing that I would say related to that is that substance abuse rates and suicide rates in the gay population are way, way elevated. And I just say that kind of as it always hits me when I see it because it is, I think it has to do a lot with they're not accepted culturally, and that's a problem you get when you step into that lifestyle. But I think another part of it is they can't find what they're looking for in that lifestyle. So... Yeah. Again, I think a lot of that, how it all plays out, again, gets back to a number of different factors. But if you have a strong-willed, risk-taking temperament who has a father who is angry, hostile, he's probably, in my experience, the more likely to kind of be the antisocial guy when he grows up, maybe exploit women, et cetera. What I see more often in the more sensitive temperament is when they don't connect well with dad, when they're not, don't feel accepted in terms of who they are and their differences. That's a problem. And there's usually some kind of connection with mom because they didn't feel accepted by dad, and that's another piece. And again, I see less of that. I see more of there was an issue. There was some kind of sexual act that happened that led to some conditioning. But I think this other piece of boys that in our culture are seen as in our culture there we have an idea of what men are like and what women are like, and we don't often have a lot of tolerance for differences. And so the young boy who is sensitive. Likes colors, likes the arts, that's a kid that's probably more at risk for a gay lifestyle simply because if he doesn't feel like he is accepted by men in his family and in his culture, he will find acceptance somewhere. And the whole sense of I don't fit at home can be very confusing and can lead to maybe I'm not like them, maybe I am like this, but we seek to find belonging and significance somewhere. We will find it. We may do it in useless ways, but we will seek for it. And that temperament, that kind of that, the sensitive one, is probably more at risk than other temperaments of feeling like something's wrong with me and I need to go elsewhere to figure out, you know, kind of who I am. Is that? Without molestation, that temperament, I think, is more at risk for feeling like I don't fit, and then they will find fit. Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Speaking of phobias, I have a phobia of spiders, which happened when I was 5 years old. And my remedy to reverse that is to kill everyone that I see. Actually, the only spiders I fear are the ones that go thump when they fall on the floor, the large ones. I'll give you the whole story someday. All right, next week we're going to start looking at the various passages in the Bible that address homosexuality. It seems, at least from what I can tell, six main arguments that are used to morally justify homosexual behavior. And I'm just going to introduce them real quickly here this morning, and then we'll go over them a little bit more next week. There is no God. If there's no God, then of course there's no moral absolutes, no ultimate accountability, and everybody is free to do what is right in their own eyes. If there is a God, secondly, he doesn't care how we live. He has the whole universe to worry about. How we conduct our puny little lives isn't something he's going to concern himself with. In fact, about a month ago, I read a letter to the editor appealing to this very argument. God doesn't care whether I share my bed with a man or a woman. He's got bigger things to deal with. Third, if God is concerned about morality, he hasn't made that known. There are many holy books in the world from all the major religions, each claiming to be the revelation from God. We have no way to know which one of them is, or for that matter, if any of them is. Four, if the Christian Bible is God's revelation, then the verses that appear to condemn homosexuality are no longer relevant. They have to do with respecting the culture of the ancient world and are not to be understood as applying to all peoples at all times and all civilizations. And since our culture is tolerant toward homosexuality, God's people should be as well. Five, if these passages are not conditioned by culture but are relevant to all peoples at all times, they are not, upon closer examination, actually condemning homosexuality per se. Such verses have been misunderstood. What is being condemned are certain homosexual abuses, not homosexuality itself. And six, if there are passages that categorically condemn all homosexual behavior, there are other principles in God's Word, higher laws, that supersede these specific commands. Because God is love and would not condemn any genuine love in any form, and he would not condemn genuine love in any form, including homosexual love, the law of love trumps all other laws. So, again, just to summarize, and this kind of sets us up for next week, there is no God. Even if there were a God, he doesn't care about my sexual behavior. Even if he did care, I have no way of knowing. Even if the Bible appears to tell me, such passages no longer apply. Even if they do apply, they are not saying what we think they are saying. And even if they are saying what we think they are saying, there are other principles in the Bible that overrides those particular verses. So, next week, we will tackle some of this and then dive into the various passages. All right, well, let's go ahead and stand at this time. We'll have the children come back in and the musicians.